Hello, and welcome to One World, One Health, where we take a look at some of the biggest problems facing our world. I'm Maggie Fox. This podcast is brought to you by the One Health Trust, with bite-sized insights into ways to help address challenges such as infectious diseases, climate change, and pollution. A One Health approach recognizes that everything on this planet, the animals, plants and people, and the climate and the environment are all linked. Climate change is affecting everyone everywhere, but one place people often forget to look is underwater. That's too bad because it's beautiful down there, especially in and around coral reefs. A living reef is beautiful in and of itself, with billions of tiny, colorful organisms living literally on top of one another. They, of course, provide food and shelter for fish and many other species of animals. Plus, they provide a physical barrier protecting coastal areas from ocean storms and floods. And they're the source of many newly discovered species, maybe even future antibiotics or cancer drugs. Alizé Zimmerman is dedicated to saving coral reefs. She's the director of the Turks and Caicos Reef Fund, a group working to preserve these valuable resources. She's joining us in this episode of One World, One Health to tell us about some of the creative ways her group has found to save coral. Alizé, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why do we need to bother about coral? I mean, it's pretty and all, but does humanity need it?
Oh, what a great question to start. I mean, I love coral in so many ways. They are one of the most fascinating animals on Earth. And so I stress that animal part. Yes, humanity does need coral reefs. Our dependence on coral reefs, especially for coastal communities, is vast. So yes, they are pretty. And I do like to say that no matter what, we do need to maintain and keep that connection to the joy that nature brings. As a human species, I think that's a really big part of our disconnect. But I do tell people, especially for the Turks and Caicos, which is where my specialties lie, is that the coral reefs are the source of everything. They are quite literally the source of the physical land on which I'm currently standing. We are an ancient coral reef system, these islands. They are the source of our food security. They are the source of our coastal protection. And this is not just for places like the Turks and Caicos, but coastal communities along the east coast of the United States, the Southern East Coast, all around the world. If you live along the coast, then in some way you are likely protected. The land on which you are is protected by these coral reef ecosystems. And then, of course, 25% of all marine life gather around, live in, depend on coral reef ecosystems.
And you're creating what it sounds to me like a kind of Noah's Ark to save coral. Can you tell us a little bit about the project?
So essentially, yes, a Noah's Ark, if you will. But instead of just having a male and female or two specimens with coral, we need a selection of genetic material. So what's called genotypes, which are genetically unique individuals. And corals are a colonial animal. So imagine a little upside down jellyfish that lives in a rock that it creates itself. In order to keep certain species from extinction, we are, alongside many other organizations, creating a biobank of coral so that if and when the conditions in the wild are more favorable to keeping ecosystems alive, then those species haven't been lost forever. A lot of work is being put into doing that. And if the reason behind the coral ark or biobank, that is a very large question that really leads back to, in our case, stony coral tissue loss disease and an epidemic that is changing face of coral reefs at an unprecedented rate in an unprecedented way in the Caribbean Atlantic. And so it's a time-sensitive necessity to bring these corals in.
So what you're saying is this is an urgent problem. Tell us about this stony coral tissue loss disease, what it is and how it's come about.
Stony coral tissue loss disease is still being figured out, funnily enough. So it first appeared in 2014 in Miami during routine monitoring for a dredge project. And so we're coming on 10 years and millions of dollars have been invested into the research, but coral microbiomes are incredibly complex. And so we still don't have a definitive answer as to what is SCTLD. We know that it has a bacterial component because antibiotics stop the progression. They do not inoculate However, more recent research is actually showing a viral component, and it would be a plant virus that attacks the symbiotic algae within the coral tissue, the zooxanthellae, and then a secondary bacterial infection, more opportunistic.
So it's complicated, just like the ecosystem that the coral live in.
Yes, exactly. It's incredibly complicated. Coral are the most complicated, simple creatures you will ever meet. They are incredibly simple when you just look at them in their basic form, and yet they have the complexity of being able to spawn at the same time hundreds of miles apart. They have the complexity of being able to lose their symbiotic algae, regain their algae, reproduce, change sex.
Maybe we should explain a little bit to listeners who might not know how the symbiosis between the coral and the algae.
So a coral in and of itself, the animal, which does look like a little upside down jellyfish, it has these tentacles and a mouth, each polyp. And it has a best friend that lives inside its skin that gives it color. And that is an algae, a symbiotic algae. And these zooxanthellae is what they're called, or zooks. They actually photosynthesize, and they provide up to 80% of the coral's nutrition. And the other 20% is actually by grabbing phytoplankton and actually eating. I have fed worms and shrimp to coral. I've seen them eat a hermit crab. They very much are omnivores. And so when I say corals are an animal, they really do. They react. They love to eat. And so that symbiotic relationship between the coral and the algae is one of the main ways that corals are so resilient, but also what gives them their beautiful colors as well.
Okay, now it sounds like they're really resilient creatures. So it seems to me that it's exceptionally worrying that there's something that can kill something so adaptable.
It is exceptionally worrying. They are resilient. When the conditions are kind of at their norm, coral will continue. They are essentially immortal. I've seen corals that are 500 plus years old. There are 1,000 plus year old colonies, and they continue to grow and grow. And yes, when you see something that has survived the last 500 years of what has been thrown at and the changes in the environment, and in the span of less than a year, they're just wiped out, it makes you realize there's something much, much bigger now.
And you're looking at that. You say there's something bacterial, something viral. Do water temperatures have anything to do with it?
So when it was first observed, that had been an unusually hot summer, although 10 years later, our definition of unusually hot has unfortunately changed. This year was unusual hot. I've never seen anything like it. But what we did see actually when we got it here in 2019 was that when the coral started to bleach, the disease progression actually stopped. And this is where that first interest in it being a potential plant virus that starts the process of what becomes SCTLD would go. And so this summer we had the same thing. We had the most severe bleaching event we've ever seen. Shocking. And now that the corals are regaining their symbiotic algae, we are seeing an outbreak of this disease. And the corals are still weak from months of being without their main source of nutrition. So the correlation isn't this. It's hard to say, well, when the bleaching happens, the disease stops, because that doesn't sound like it's a positive. But unfortunately, the correlation here is a hard one for the corals, because damned if they do, damned if they don't, as far as the algae at the moment.
How hard are they to keep alive?
You know what? They're picky. They are a little prima donna divas. The temperature needs to be just right. The light needs to be just right. The water flow. As they grow, they start absorbing calcium to grow and alkalinity. So we have to dose the water to keep their nutrients up. It's not something you can just pick up. Until we got the grant and realized that we really needed to do this work, I had no background. And so we had to partner with a scientific organization that's familiar with coral husbandry and really learn the water chemistry parameters. But anyone can do it, because I never had a goldfish in a tank before. And I, no pressure or anything, have some of the most endangered species in the region who living under our roof. So yeah, there is a learning curve, but it is something that I think one of our main passions is showing that small islands with limited resources can do this. And if we can create hubs around the world or throughout the region, then we really have a chance to keep that genetic diversity going.
And then how do you protect the coral from disease? Can we talk a little bit about the antibiotic treatments you're using?
Back in 2019, a pharmaceutical company in Florida called Ocean Alchemist, which was actually just a couple who took time and got given permission from the lab they worked in during the day to use the lab at night to try and formulate something that could help save coral. And it's called Base2B, and it's a pharmaceutically designed paste that is both hydrophobic and slow releasing. But the idea is we mix amoxicillin at a 1-to-8 ratio in that paste. And so, for example, 50 grams of amoxicillin to 400 grams, the Base2B, which would be enough to treat 10 large corals and up to 20 smaller ones. So we mix all that up, and it's this like thick, almost like a cake batter. And then we use a spatula and we shove it into these 60 milliliter catheter tip syringes. And we actually apply that paste directly onto the lesion margin. So this disease has a very specific demarcation of where it's sick versus healthy, although we don't know how far into the healthy tissue the disease is already, the pathogen is already traversed. So usually we go along the edge and over one or two polyps or say a centimeter or two into the healthy tissue. And we cover that with this paste, which is then absorbed over 3 days. It has a really high success rate for stopping individual lesions. However, it has no inoculative effects. So there's no, it doesn't prevent reinfection, which is one of the bigger issues. So, and the idea for it is to use it to treat large target colonies that are reproductive, that have already survived 500 plus years, and that we see die. The entire 500 years of history of tissue is gone in 2 weeks. Keeping those alive so that they can reproduce and continue populating the reef is the point of the antibiotic treatment, rather than trying to go and save everything.
Now, one big global problem, of course, is antibiotic resistance. And to many people, it sounds dangerous to be putting antibiotics right into the ocean. So how do you guard against just spreading these precious drugs willy-nilly into the environment?
The time-sensitive nature of this disease and the rapidity with which it is putting out entire species leaves very little time for prolonged experimentation. So yes, we are putting the antibiotic, but in this paste, which again is hydrophobic, so the idea is it prevents or minimizes to the best that it can any leaching directly into the water and releases it into the coral, but on a small and targeted base. So as much as I agree it's not the ideal solution, scientists are working really hard to try and find alternatives. Probiotics are definitely the route that we're looking at, but we're 5, maybe 10 years away from something that's going to be creatable and marketable in our small island countries. And so what will be left in 5 or 10 years is the question.
And you also mentioned that the antibiotics, just as in anything you use antibiotics for, it's not a vaccine. Is there work on somehow vaccinating these corals?
So probiotics is really the vaccine option there, because what's wonderful in lab tests out of Dr. Ushijima's lab with the Smithsonian that they've seen is that when finding the specific bacteria that lives in that one colony that seems to be immune and replicating that, those probiotics then colonize not only the colony that you treat with them, but they will actually go and colonize the colony next to them. So this gives us an opportunity to treat one coral and maybe inoculate 10, which, I mean, that is a wonderful goal. But probiotics require a different formula for every little area because we have different microbiomes.
And the microbiome is your own personal collection of organisms, of microorganisms. And like humans do, coral also have a microbiome.
Exactly, and a complicated one at that. But that is the goal, is to move away from antibiotics. And we have tested other non-antibiotic treatments, and as I mentioned, really are trying to only use it on very specific large colonies to minimize the use of it.
Alizé, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Maggie. It was a real pleasure, and I appreciate any opportunity to highlight the plight of our oceans and coral reefs.
Listeners, if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it. You can learn more about this podcast and other important topics at onehealthtrust.org. And let us know what else you'd like to hear about at owoh@onehealthtrust.org. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to One World, One Health, brought to you by the One Health Trust. I'm Ramanan Lakshminarayan, founder and president of the One Health Trust. You can subscribe to One World, One Health on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on social media at One Health Trust, one word, for updates on One World, One Health and the latest in research on One Health issues like drug resistance, disease spillovers, and the social determinants of health. Finally, please do consider donating to the One Health Trust to support this podcast and other initiatives and research that help us promote health and well-being worldwide. Until next time.